But we begin today with a big story in Washington, a letter with possible traces of the toxin ricin sent to a senator, echoes of the anthrax scares of more than a decade ago. Todd Zwillick on that. Todd, are you with us?
Hi, John.
Todd also will have the Washington response to the Boston bombings investigation, because that's being headed up in large part in Washington. But we want to shout out to Callie Crossley, host of Under the Radar program at WGBH Boston Public Radio, who did such extraordinary work on this program yesterday. Callie, how's everything going?
Hello, John. It's going okay.
And give us the pulse of Boston before we talk about the latest terror story with Todd.
Determined, a little somber, but people are out and about. You're reminded, as I was this morning, because I took a part of my trip on the T, and there were the camouflaged National Guardsmen, not with guns on my side of the river, but still they were there, and they were being dispersed by their leader as I walked into the station. So we know what's happening, and we're living in the aftermath.
Indeed, as we are around the United States. Todd Zwillick, focusing on the situation in Washington, what do we know, and unfold the details as we learned them, about this ricin alleged incident involving a letter sent to a senator?
Yeah, well, we know very little, John. Just last night, reports of an envelope mailed to the office of Senator Roger Wicker. He's from Mississippi. He's a Republican. Now, ever since the anthrax attacks in 2001, when anthrax letters were sent to the offices of several senators and several media outlets, mail on Capitol Hill has been processed at a secure outside facility. It's actually not even in the district. It's in Prince George's County, right over the border in Maryland. At that facility, they detected a white granular substance in this letter, which was postmarked Memphis, Tennessee, alerted the Capitol Police. The Capitol Police, of course, alerting Senator Wicker, other senators' offices, and eventually the media. They don't know the source of that letter. Some senators telling reporters, including me last night, that in an intelligence briefing, they are told the Capitol Police have a suspect, not named, but somebody who mails, apparently sends a lot of letters to senators. And that's all we are told at this point. Don't know the source of that letter, and Senator Wicker says he's grateful for the work of the Capitol Police, but people are watching that situation closely, John.
I'm wondering if this has anything to do with the large number of votes coming up on gun legislation. The Capitol's going to be dominated by that later today.
Yeah, it is. Now, there's a mini votorama on the gun legislation finally today. This afternoon, John, here's what we're looking at. 9 votes on amendments to the gun bill. This is really a make or break moment for gun control legislation in this country. It will include the bipartisan background checks amendment between Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania that we have discussed. That amendment, John, is in peril. It is short of the votes right now. Senator Manchin saying even today that he thinks he probably doesn't have the votes at this point. There will be votes on assault weapons bans, high-capacity clips, mental health services, and even amendments expanding gun rights. Senator John Cornyn of Texas, John, has an amendment that would allow if a gun owner from a state that has a concealed carry permit to have that permit be valid if they go to another state that has concealed carry. That's a right they don't have now, would basically expand concealed carry permits. It's called reciprocity, if you want to look it up. There'll be a vote on that, too. When all of this is over at the end of the day, senators will then size up what has passed and what has not passed, and it will determine what other amendments go on with this bill and whether it collapses under its own weight. Keeping in mind, of course, the House of Representatives, John, the conservative Republican House, has very little, if any, interest in gun control legislation. They are watching closely to see what the Senate puts on their backs to see if any of this can pass.
And I don't need to look up the word reciprocity, Young Zwillick, but thank you very much for that suggestion.
Well, only what's in terms the sense of what it means to the gun debate.
I know. I'm just kidding you. What's the sense of the federal response to the Boston investigation before we go to Cali?
Well, John, just a lot of not knowing at this point. There is a sense that this could really affect a gun control debate. What if this is a domestic person who has some opinion about guns? There is a sense that this could affect immigration if it's someone who came into the country illegally, overstayed a visa. We don't know. It could certainly affect the security debate, and people are also saying, look, if you have sequestration and that's affecting the amount of money that goes to local responders, police, EMS, and local intelligence, why would you cut that money when we have security concerns like this? The problem, of course, nobody knows. Janet Napolitano, Homeland Security Secretary and FBI Director Robert Mueller, on the Hill last night, John, briefing lawmakers, basically telling them they don't have any solid leads and they don't know who's behind this. Napolitano back on the Hill today, and we may know more. But for right now, everybody is waiting and watching so they know what direction to take.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick on Capitol Hill. Thanks so much, Todd.
Pleasure.
So, Callie Crossley, in Boston, law enforcement has been suggesting and encouraging people with any information, with any video, with any pictures of what happened on Marathon Day there at the finish line to possibly deliver what could be evidence. How's that being received up there in Boston?
Oh, they're getting a great response. They mentioned yesterday in the press conference that they'd gotten already reviewed 20,000 videos and images, and they want more and more. And I can't say enough about that, because anybody could see one picture and be prompted to remember something. I think the release of the photos of the remnants of the pressure cooker was very helpful in getting people to really think about making sure they got those pictures into the authorities for their review. People want.
And you're referring to pictures of a piece of metal that obviously came from what looks like a pressure cooker, which possibly was the encasement for the bomb. That's the latest theory.
That, and also there was a nylon bag, don't know if it was a backpack or just a duffel bag, but that has a lot of people searching through their photos for anything that they think might be helpful, and anything at this point could be helpful. Back to the comment that Todd made, there's a lot of feeling about domestic terrorists here now. I mean, that word terrorism is being carefully used, but among the folk, not the official folk. I mean, that's what we're hearing more and more, that people are feeling as though that was a motivation for someone here homegrown.
Callie Crossley riding the T, taking. Go ahead, Callie.
No, and I was just going to say, just in conclusion, that one of the most heart-wrenching moments last night was a vigil at the home of, in the neighborhood of the young victim, the youngest victim who was identified. And it was in Dorchester. And Dorchester is a community that is a mix of race and class. And everybody was there, the people we call the originally from Dorchester people, the OFDs, the new Bostonians, and everyone from across the city, because we're all feeling it.
Callie Crossley, host of the show Under the Radar with Callie Crossley for WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Thanks, Callie.
Thank you.
What were those explosive devices in Boston? Assembled after a simple trip to Crate and Barrel or Williams-Sonoma or Walmart in the hardware store? Of course, we have no idea how the bombs were assembled. No trail of purchases that we know of. But the early indication is that these bombs are off-the-shelf technology requiring no terribly sophisticated knowledge and no exotic ingredients. Eric Schmidt is national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Do we have a recipe? You heard Callie talking about the pressure cooker there.
Well, it's a recipe that comes right out of the jihadi cookbook, if you will. This is actually a recipe, these pressure cookers, that's been on some of the online websites for Al-Qaeda affiliates, like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. This is the Yemen-based organization that was responsible for the so-called underpants bomber a few years ago. And it is very simple. It's perhaps for less than $100, you can buy these ingredients, a pressure cooker. The ones that were apparently used in Boston were about 6 liters, filled with shrapnel such as sharp nails, metal pellets, ball bearings, some black powder that went in there, and some kind of a pretty basic timing device, just like a kitchen timer. They locked the lid back down. The bomber put it in a black nylon duffel bag, apparently, and set it down, and off he went. Some time later, the bombs go off.
Is this in part a proliferation story in the sense that maybe the narrative begins with Al-Qaeda and some of these terrorist organizations that you've described, but now it is circulated so widely that it wouldn't require anyone in a particular organization to get access to any of this technology or even the know-how?
Certainly these Al-Qaeda and other extremist organizations have been putting out this kind of information to make it available on their English language websites to Americans, but also in the West in general. And it is so basic that you don't necessarily have to believe in the Al-Qaeda ideology at all. That's kind of a place where you can go shopping, if you will. But other extremist organizations, including right-wing conspiracy organizations, have also linked into these kind of recipe books, if you will, and how-to guides and how to carry out these kind of attacks or build these kind of bombs. And so it's something you can do fairly simply, if you have any expertise in this area. And they kind of walk you through the process, unfortunately, on their online guides.
How massively does this complicate the investigation? Even though we know the ingredients, it's almost impossible to figure out who the cooks are.
Well, interestingly enough, these even with these basic household ingredients, they do carry telltale signs. I mean, I think you may have seen some of the indications yesterday on the images. There is a manufacturer listed on the bottom of the, or at least in a part of the remains of one of these pressure cookers that we saw. FBI agents can go and trace back, and in some cases they can trace back to actual lot numbers in certain idiosyncrasies in manufacturing that will give them tips and leads to perhaps the actual store where this was bought. Interestingly enough, the Eric Rudolph, who was responsible for the bombings at the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta, he also used a bomb similar to this with nails. And the FBI eventually traced the nails to a particular manufacturer because there was a slight defect in them that only affected a small number of lots. So it's a very painstaking process, but it is possible.
Eric Schmidt, national security and terrorism correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So has the bombings at the Boston Marathon made you feel less safe? Here's a message from East Hampton, Massachusetts. I'm always expecting an attack since 2001. Every venue seems so vulnerable. Wherever there are crowds, I'm now quite uncomfortable in large groups, yet I go. Tell us your story. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE. You can be a part of the conversation or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Still to come, the balance of security and liberties playing out at Guantanamo Bay. That's coming up later here on The Takeaway.